All right, shall we get started? Okay, good afternoon. Welcome everybody to the last session of Mix 11. Thanks for coming. I want to thank you on behalf of Microsoft and on behalf of, specifically for myself, the Windows Phone team. We've given you a lot of information over the last couple of days, and I hope you're all excited to get your hands on the tools and start building some really cool apps on the new Mango platform. So, as you've probably seen over the past week, Mix is a pretty big conference, a lot of organization that goes into it, a lot of preparation, a lot of people working here to make sure that you guys have a really great time. And so they ask us to make sure that we have our slides prepared well in advance and locked down and submitted, and don't make any additional changes so that there's no, you know, last minute surprises when we actually get up here on stage. But I couldn't resist adding one last slide to my presentation this morning, having seen the activity that was going on Twitter yesterday when we announced that we were adding a database to the Mango platform. The amount of excitement, not only in the keynote, but also out on Twitter, people just really excited to see a database finally come to Windows Phone and be ready to start building applications. It's just, it makes us really excited. I sent this back to the team in Redmond. We're just turning on the afterburners now to make sure that we put this out with really high quality so that you can start building great, really great applications. So anybody in the room that was one of these tweets? No? These are all remote viewers? All right. Pretty cool. So I'm going to talk about two things. So database got a lot of notice yesterday, but we're also going to be adding contacts and calendar APIs, so giving you the ability to do link against both SQL databases for your own applications and your own user data, as well as taking advantage of some of the interesting and rich user data that's already available on the phone. And so I'm going to walk through both of those topics today. Now, I'm guessing that since this is a Microsoft conference, a lot of you are familiar with Silverlight and some of our other environments, that Link is not going to be something that's too foreign. Let me just get a quick show of hands. How many people are familiar with Link? Excellent. Okay, so there's not going to be a lot you see today that's going to look too crazy. But of course, Link, just to summarize, is a language integrated query. And so it's the ability to do queries against a wide variety of different data sources from within your managed application. And so in 7, we had couple of options for doing link. You could do link against object collections. You could also do link against XML. So our wide variety of data sources in Windows Phone 7 was effectively 2. And I'm sure a bunch of you use both of these. Standard scenario is you go out to the cloud, you download some data from a web service, you might do a link to XML query against that data, turn that into a set of objects, put those into an enumerable collection, and then do queries against that collection. So that enables a lot of scenarios. It's pretty powerful. But we wanted to build on that in Mango and add some additional data sources to make your applications even that much more rich and compelling. And so as we've already discussed, we're enabling link to SQL, link to user data, primarily in the form of contacts and appointments. And finally, something I'm not going to talk too deeply about, but we are enabling link to OData as well. And so how many people are familiar with OData? Again, pretty good showing there. So OData is a way to expose data sources that you have in your cloud service in a really simple way so that you can actually do link queries against that from your clients. And the OData team has done a bunch of great work to enable that to work on Windows Phone in Mango. And so actually the demo that I'm going to be showing you today is making use of that. So just to set a little bit of context about what we were thinking about when we were building our data access strategy for Windows Phone, I thought I'd walk through a couple of just sort of canonical scenarios to see, just kind of align expectations about the types of applications that we expect you to build and really where we've optimized the platform. So I expect that a lot of the things you see on here will resonate for you. These will look like applications that maybe you've already built in 7 or that you would like to build. If there are other types of applications that you don't see in this list, I'd definitely like to talk to you afterwards, get an idea of maybe where the gaps are some of the scenarios that you're interested in that maybe you don't feel like we're tackling in this release, because we're obviously always seeking to improve. So the first one is what I call sort of the complex user data schema. So an example of this is a shopping list application. This is actually an application that Microsoft shipped as part of 7 as a sample. And so clearly this is something that you can do without a database, right? You get your object graph. The user enters data. They enter items into their lists. They maybe add, you know, favorites and other properties. And you go and turn around and serialize that into maybe an XML file or some sort of binary format, store that in isolated storage. Next time the app starts up, you reload it into memory, and off you go. You can do your link queries against those collections. You can manipulate it in all kinds of different ways. So it's possible to build this application on Windows Phone 7, and in fact, we did. But if you've built an application like this, you probably realize that as your data schema gets more complicated, as the amount of data that you're storing gets larger, it becomes more and more difficult to actually manage this application. You have more code than you would like to have. Maybe you have some performance problems that you wouldn't like to see. And so if you built this application using a database, it would be much easier to manage, much easier to iterate on, add new features. As we saw in the keynote yesterday, adding a search feature to an RSS reader took literally 15 minutes. Now, where the shopping list is something that is definitely doable in 7, with, you know, a couple of caveats, as I just mentioned, a dictionary-type application or, you know, any type of application that has a large amount of reference data is going to be much more difficult to build. So if you think about how you would build an offline dictionary-type application in Windows Phone today, you would really have to effectively build your own database, right? You would divide up your reference data set into a bunch of smaller files. You would have to figure out a way that when the user does a search, you pull out the right file, you deserialize that into memory, and then you load that up. It's a very, very difficult thing to do in a performant way, and so this is clearly a scenario that we wanted to go ahead and tackle in Mango. But the dictionary is actually a pretty special case. So the case where you've got an application that has a large amount of reference data that you want to store locally on the phone is something of a niche scenario, right? What's actually a lot more common is a case where you've got a large reference database that's actually stored up in the cloud, possibly exposed with an OData service, for example. And then you have some user data on the phone, maybe some subset of that reference data from the cloud, plus a bunch of user-initiated data points that you want to store. You want to mash those up together and create an application on the phone that takes advantage of those two data sources brought together. And so this is actually the type of application that I'm going to be walking you through today as a demo. And it's clearly one that we wanted to make really easy to build. And then switching gears just a little bit, moving away from the database to more to the user data side, in Windows Phone 7, we have a set of tasks that people are probably familiar with. So you've got a phone number chooser, an email chooser, that allows your application to launch a first-party task, allows the user to pan through his contact list and choose an item. Your application gets back a phone number, an email address, and you can do something with that. But as I'm sure you know, there are a bunch of scenarios that you can't actually enable or are very difficult to enable with only that capability. So, for example, if you wanted to filter your contact, look for people that have birthdays in the next month, for example, because you're doing some sort of birthday reminder application, maybe using the background alarms that we've talked about in a couple of sessions, there's no way to do that in 7. And so by enabling a way for you to query the contact list directly, this is the type of application you can build. Secondly, there's actually no way for you to query the appointments database or the calendar database at all in 7. And so what we're enabling is for you to be able to query the calendar, maybe look for a slot for an appointment, and then choose that as you see in the animation here. So that's just a set of scenarios that really drove our thinking around our data access strategy. I hope some of those resonate with you. As I say, if there's scenarios that you don't see in that list that you think have different requirements, I'd definitely love to talk to you afterwards and get an idea of maybe where we have some gaps. But before I go any further, I want to just do a quick demo. So this is basically a mobile wine application, mobile wine manager application. So fitting into the category of sort of a web service cache. This is based on an OData service that's now in beta from wine.com. And so I'm using OData to go out to the web to get some reference data, pull that down to the device, and then have the user add some of their own data and mash those two things up together. So what I've got here is a panorama control, obviously, that's got some items that I added earlier. So the idea is I can keep track of some of the wines that I have at home, maybe some that I've marked as favorites, or wines that I've consumed recently. As you can see, I've been having a good time at Mix, getting through a few bottles. And so you might be looking at this and saying, okay, this looks like an application that I may have seen in the marketplace in 7. What's the big deal, right? Well, actually, let me rephrase. I think the people in this room probably realize what the big deal is, but I can imagine that you're going to go home and when you get the tools, start building an application somewhat like this, and you'll run up to your significant other and say, look at this, it's so cool, and they're going to say, what's the big deal, right? Why does it matter that we added a database because this looks exactly like something. Of course, what the big deal is you can imagine I may have hundreds or even thousands of bottles that I've pulled down from that cloud service and stored locally on the phone, and I want to display just a handful of those in this panorama control, right? So I only want to display, say, the last, the 10 most recent bottles that I've added to my home collection in the at-home item, or maybe the last, you know, 5 that I've added as favorites. And so if you were to try to do that in 7, there's a lot of management that you need to do. Again, like I was talking about in the dictionary case, you have to go and manage how you break up that data, store it in isolated storage, how you're going to query it back and bind it to your UI. And you end up having a pretty tight coupling between your UI layer and the way that you're persisting your data. So for example, if you wanted to have the items in the at-home panel sorted by the date that you added them, then you might organize your data in the files that way. If you then change your mind on how you want to display those things, then you know, you're going to have to go and change the way that you've stored that information. And so that's clearly not ideal. So we'll come back to this application a little later and dive into some of the items in code. But I wanted to just kind of give you an idea of what we're going to be looking at. Get back. There we go. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the details of the database support that we're adding in Mango. So the first thing to point out is that there's actually two locations on the phone or within sort of your apps container where data can be stored. So I think most people are probably familiar with isolated storage, right? It's your sort of sandbox part of the file system where you have file I/O APIs that you can read and write files, you can delete them, create directories, all that good stuff. But there's actually a second location where data gets stored, and that's in what we call the app data or the install folder. And you can think of that as effectively the exploded contents of your Zap package. So you publish an application up to the marketplace, it comes packaged in a Zap, we explode that on installation and put everything into that app data folder. So the key properties of that folder are, one, that everything in there is read-only, so you can only access it for read. And secondly, that when you do an application update, that folder gets blown away and everything that comes down in the updated version of the Zap package will get installed in there. And so unlike isolated storage, which stays intact as your application goes through its update cycles, that location is continually being blown away and reinstalled as you're doing your updates. So today, you can have XML files or other types of data files stored in your package that get written into the app data folder. And you can also have flat files stored in isolated storage, as well as the isolated storage settings API, which gives you basically a property bag for storing your objects. And so pretty naturally, we're going to extend that to allow you to store databases in both of those. The real deciding point here on where you're going to put your database is if you have reference data that you want to populate in advance, you're going to want to store that in the app data folder and access it in a read-only fashion. If you have user data that's going to be created and modified and deleted at runtime, clearly that's going to go in isolated storage. So two locations to think about for storing your database, and both of them are fully supported. So just briefly on the architecture, I hope a bunch of you had a chance to see Ishvan's talk yesterday. He obviously has a great depth in the data space, and so I'd encourage you, if you missed it, to go back and take a look at that. He spent a lot of time talking about the data investments that we're making in Mango. But I just want to go through this briefly so you have an idea of sort of what the stack looks like. So at the top, I mentioned everything is based on, and so this query, even if you haven't written linked to SQL code before, should look pretty familiar. I'll just take a quick break there and ask, how many people are familiar with linked to SQL from the desktop? Wow, okay, good stuff. So this is going to be pretty straightforward for you guys. But if you aren't familiar with linked to SQL, I think this will still look pretty straightforward. But that's really the type of queries and the type of code that your application is going to write. Underneath the covers, we actually have the linked to SQL component, which is managing turning all of your database records that you're querying into a set of objects, managing the ties between those objects back down to the database for when you do updates, tracking changes, doing updates. There's a set of operations that happen in there. Linked to SQL deals with expression trees, which is kind of the gobbledygook that you see in the middle of the screen there. Luckily, your application doesn't need to do that. Deal with that. And ultimately, it gets turned into a set of raw SQL statements that will get executed against a SQL CE database. And so, as you can see, you go from truly link down to SQL, and then you're operating against that SQL database. Now, since there were a bunch of hands that went up in the room for having familiarity and experience with link to SQL from the desktop, I'll take this opportunity to point out a couple of key differences on the phone. So linked to SQL on the desktop, you primarily are writing queries like you have at the top of the screen, so link queries that get turned into SQL by the platform. But a lot of you probably know that you also have some backdoor capabilities to be able to execute raw SQL, DDL, or DML, or to be able to get access to some ADO.NET objects. Those facilities are not going to be available in the phone. So in the interest of keeping our platform consistent and pretty tight in terms of dealing with objects and dealing with managed concepts, we are not enabling those on the phone. So you'll be writing exclusively link queries dealing with objects, which brings us to objects, objects, objects. So link to SQL is an object relational mapper, as many of you probably know. And since the early days of object relational mapping technologies, there's been one of those kind of religious debates, right? Do you map from the objects to the relations, or do you map from the relations to the objects? So with Mango, we've taken the position that you map from the objects to the relations. And so you're going to be writing your object graph in your application. So in this case, I'm dealing with a wine application, so I've got objects like wines and varietals and vineyards and vintages, and you can imagine all the different types of objects I might have in this type of application. And I'm going to turn that into a data schema under the hood. And so the platform is going to take care of turning the object graph that you've defined in your application down into the appropriate database schema. And so the way that we do that is you decorate your objects and your properties with some data persistence attributes. We go and interrogate those attributes at runtime and create the appropriate schema under the hood. So when you're making changes to your application, or making changes to the data in your application, you're always dealing with objects. So you're making changes to the properties of those objects, you're deleting items out of a collection, you're adding new items to the collection, and then there's an explicit submit API that allows you to actually flush those down to the database layer. Now, obviously, over time, the requirements of your application are going to change. People are going to ask for new features. You're going to want to make some additions to your database schema and your object graph. And so the thing to remember is you're always dealing with objects. So you're going to come back up to the object layer. You're going to make the changes that you would make to your application even if you weren't using a database underneath the hood. You're going to add in the new objects, add in the new properties, add those new, add the same type of data persistence attributes that you would need for building an application for the first time, and then we're going to enable you through a set of new managed APIs to actually do upgrades of that database. So here I'm adding a winemaker's object. I call into the database schema updater APIs that we provide, and that actually pushes those changes down to the database layer. Okay. So I have code on the slide here, but I'm actually going to jump over into Visual Studio. Hope it doesn't give the screen artifacts that it did the previous time. Okay, so let's walk through the basic steps you need to do to build the application that that I showed earlier. So the first one is you're going to define a data context. The data context is effectively the glue of the object relational mapper. It's the piece that actually manages the mapping. And so this is where you're going to see some database type concepts start to pop up, right? So you're going to have a table for wines, a table for vineyards, a table for varietals, and so on. And so this is where you're going to create the mapping from your object layer down to your database layer. The second thing you need to do is actually go and define what those tables are going to look like. So you do that. You do that with the table attribute on the object, which basically tells the data context when you go and create the database what are the properties that you want to map down to a set of columns. And so there's this column attribute that will tie that down. You can set the primary key. There's a set of sort of database-specific attributes that you can tie in at your object model here. And the idea is that really within this data context is the only place that you should really have database-specific type concepts popping up. So this, you know, you think of this as being down in sort of the model level of your MVVM, and the upper layers, your views and your view models, shouldn't really need to know that they're dealing with a database. They're not talking about tables and columns. They're just talking about objects and properties on those objects. So you can do a number of the things that you would expect to be able to do when creating a database. You can create indices, which is something that's going to be we're going to talk a little bit about in the performance section. Clearly, any properties that you're querying often, you're going to want to create secondary indices on. And this is what this is all you really need to do to get your database set up to be created at runtime. So let me jump over to my app.xaml.cs, which is where I'm actually doing the database creation. So here I'm newing up a wine data context, which is my custom data context for this database. And I'm passing in the location of the database, or where I want to create the database file. So the keen observers in the audience will notice this kind of funky isostore :/ syntax. If you remember back to when I was talking about there being two locations for data in your application, the isolated storage folder and the app data folder, we're introducing this type of URI scheme so that you can differentiate between those two locations. And so if you want to create a database in the isolated storage location, you'll use this isostore keyword. If you want to access, not create, because it's read-only, if you want to access a database that you've prepackaged in your Zap, you're going to use the app data :/ keyword. Finally, just a couple of examples of queries. So I've actually got a couple of different types of queries here. So the first one, which is similar to what I had shown in the slide, is just a basic link query, right? So I'm doing a where, I'm doing an order by. Those are getting translated down into the appropriate SQL statements. And then I'm actually materializing out to a list so that I can bind to my UI. So that's kind of the standard way that you're going to write your queries, at least during development initially. We've also got this compiled query capability. So in Link to SQL, you can pre-compile your query, which basically creates your SQL query up front. And then if you're iterating through that query multiple times, you're going to get a nice performance benefit because we're not having to regenerate the SQL every single time. Okay. Let's jump back over to the slides. We talked about queries. Again, this is apart from the couple of caveats that I made with respect to raw SQL access and ADO.NET objects. Otherwise, all of your knowledge from Link to SQL on the desktop is going to transfer over nicely to the phone. So I'm not going to go super deep on how to do all the different types of queries and you know the tweaks that you can do. All of the documentation that you're going to be able to find online and in books, samples, and demos and so forth, all that stuff is going to transfer over pretty nicely to the phone. So I'm just going to move along. Clearly, Link has the word query in it, and so its general usage is going to be for querying data. But in order to have an interesting application, you're probably going to want to make some updates at some point. And so let's talk a little bit about inserts, updates, and deletes, and making changes to your database at runtime. So the key thing to remember here is that it's all about the data context. So remember, the data context is the mapper and the glue of that sits between the objects and your relational database. And so when you need to make changes to your database, you're going to make those changes to the data context first. And so if we look at an example of this, you have your app code that's going down into the database. Again, we're looking at a wine-type application. So I'm going to pull up the Pinot Noirs that I have at home. Okay, so these are two database records that get materialized up into objects and are now stored in my data context. And so it's important to keep in mind that the data context, while it's the mapping between the objects and the relations, it's not only that. It's actually also an object cache. And so it's going to keep cached versions of those entities being pulled up from the database and allow you to make changes against those. So as you can imagine, if you're making changes against those objects and they're stored in a cache, you're going to need to take some action to actually flush them down to the database. And that's done through an API called submit changes. And it's pretty important to remember to actually make that API call, because if you don't, then what happens is you have your object that has changed, but the changed information has not actually been flushed out to the database. The user navigates away from your application. They come back in. You re-query from the database, and that change is actually not there. So this seems pretty straightforward. I mean, obviously, you need to flush it down to the database. Where this gets a little tricky is most likely you're going to have multi-threaded applications. You're going to have multiple copies of your data context. And so you may have cases where you've done a change against the data context in one thread. You've got a separate thread that goes to query the database. You potentially expect to get the changed version back, but you're not going to. You're going to get the version that is stored in the database. And so you need to make sure that you're consistently flushing those changes out to the disk so that your application is always consistent. So as you can see, I've made a change to that little the little penguin object, and that gets flushed out to the database. As you can see, I have pretty expensive tastes in wine, my yellowtail and little penguin. So I'm not going to jump into Visual Studio here in the interest of time, but the way that you make changes to a link to a SQL database with Link to SQL is, again, you're just dealing with objects. So even if you're not familiar with Link to SQL, this code is probably not going to look too foreign to you. You want to add a new object, you're going to new it up, set the properties, and submit it. You want to update an object, you're going to query that out from the database, make your change, and submit that down. Similarly, if you want to do a delete, you're going to query the items you want to delete, and then submit them for deletion. Of course, the key thing to keep in mind with deletes is that there is actually a database at the bottom here. And so, you know, you've got all of the foreign key constraints and the other types of protections that are there. And so if you try to do this type of delete, where I'm deleting a set of vineyards, those vineyards have a set of wines associated with them. If I haven't actually deleted those wines, I'm going to get a foreign key violation. So the way to do that is, before you actually go and delete those vineyards, make sure you iterate through and delete out the wines so that you don't actually get that exception popping up. Okay. So I mentioned that one of the things that we've changed from desktop Link to SQL is that you don't have access to raw SQL DDL and DML statements. And so one of the things you might expect that to mean for your application is that it's going to be very difficult to do schema upgrades, right? So as your application is evolving, you're adding new features, you're going to want to change the underlying schema because you can't do the types of alter table and alter column statements that you would do in SQL directly. And you need to have a way to do that. And so what we've done is augment desktop Link to SQL with a set of APIs to allow you to do, from the managed layer, a set of database schema upgrades. And so we call that a database schema updater. And it allows you to do the things that we think are going to be the most common types of upgrade scenarios. So the ability to add tables, to add columns, add indices, and add associations or foreign keys. All of those updates are completely transactional, which is pretty important on the phone because, again, you've got users moving in and out of those applications. You're in the middle of a schema upgrade. You want to make sure that that upgrade doesn't get cut off in the middle and leave your database in a strange state. So they're all completely transactional. We also give you the ability to set a version number as part of that schema upgrade. And so you can manage how you're moving your database schema forward by setting that version number. We will keep an internal version table and set that value there that you can query back the next time you launch the application to be able to check whether you actually need to perform an upgrade or not. So let's look at an example of this. So in this case, I'm just going to, again, new up a data context. I'm going to create a database schema updater using the create database schema updater API. And you'll see that version number I was referring to. I'm going to check to see, am I still on version 1 of my database schema as far as the schema stored in the isolated storage container is concerned? If so, go ahead and perform the upgrade, which in this case is adding a column. I'm going to add a bottle type for, you know, whether it's corked or twist top or what have you. Set the version number, execute that. The column will be added, and the version will be updated. So quickly, just to round out the database section of the talk, I want to go through a little bit of some of the performance tips and best practices that we've started to build up. So again, there's a ton of information about Link to SQL out there on the web and in documentation. A lot of the best practices that have been published for Link to SQL on the desktop are going to translate very nicely over to the phone. So I'd encourage you to go and read up on those and refresh your memory, maybe if you haven't written Link to SQL in a little while. But I wanted to call out a couple of things that we think are going to be specific to the phone. So the first one is, you're going to want to keep those change sets small. So if you think back to the example that I had where I was changing the bottle of Pinot from being at home to not being at home, and then submitting that down to the database, you're really going to want to keep that, the amount of information, the amount of changes to your database that are building up in that data context object cache as small as possible. And the reason that you want to do that is, as most of you know, if you've written applications for the phone, even in 7, is your application is not going to be around for very long, most likely. Users are fickle, they have a little bit of ADD, they tend to jump into your application, do something, jump out, go to another application, hit back, and so they're going to be moving around a lot. And so if you're building up a large amount of changes to persist down to the database and want to wait until you get a deactivated notification to actually submit that, there's a good chance that you're not actually going to be able to complete that submission before your application gets terminated. And so you're going to want to keep those sets small, always flushing them out to the database so that when the user relaunches the application, they can see the data that they've added. Link to SQL is fully synchronous. And so in order to maintain the responsiveness of your UI, you won't want to do any type of non-trivial operations like a big query or a big submit on a background thread so you don't actually interrupt the UI thread. If you're doing a lot of read-only queries, so for example, in my application where I've got the pano, it's just displaying some information. I'm not actually giving the user the ability to make changes to that information from that part of the UI. You'll probably want to turn off object tracking for those queries. And so if you remember, we've got the data context as a cache of the objects that are from the database. We actually need to keep track of the associations between those objects and the underlying data records. In order to do that, we need to allocate some additional memory. And so your application will get a bit of a performance boost or a memory boost from turning that off if you're only doing read-only. Finally, obviously, if you're querying certain properties pretty often, you're going to want to use that index syntax that I showed earlier to create indices. So for the reference data scenario, like the dictionary type application that I talked about earlier, you're really going to want to pre-populate that information, do that offline on your desktop, and include that in your package that gets sent down to the device. Because you don't want to make your users wait while you go out to the web and pull down 500,000 words to your dictionary. And finally, well, I've just spent the last 30-something minutes telling you about why it's so great that we have a database. It's important to keep in mind that you use the right tool for the job, right? So Link to SQL provides a query syntax and the ability to change objects in a way that's pretty easy from a development perspective. And so there's kind of this tendency to want to use a database everywhere, right? Because it just makes it so much easier to code. But if you're doing an application like, say, a game that only has a high scores list and you're tracking like 10 scores, some of the additional memory usage and startup time that's going to be required in order to initiate a connection to a database is probably not going to be worth it for the amount of change and the amount of data that you're actually tracking. And so it's important to keep in mind your user scenarios when you're thinking about whether you should just use flat files or isolated storage settings or going to a database. So with that, I'm going to switch gears, talk a little bit about user data. As I mentioned, you guys are really excited, I think, about the ability to have the ability to store data for your own applications in a database on the phone. But we've actually already got a couple of really interesting data sets and rich data sets on the phone in the form of the contacts and calendar data stores. And so it's pretty exciting that we're enabling the ability for you to do that in Mango. So the first thing I want to cover quickly, which is actually not part of the headline of this feature at all, but is a pretty nice addition to the existing feature set, is the address chooser task. So as I mentioned earlier today, you've got the ability to get a phone number and get an email from the contact list from within your application. we're rounding that out to allow you to get the address of the user. And so this makes for a pretty nice mashup with the Bing Maps direction task that we're also adding. So now in literally like 5 lines of code, you can go out, get an address for a contact that's in the user's contact database, kick that out to Bing Maps to get directions, and within a few seconds, you're on your way to your friend's house. But then what is actually the headline is direct access APIs to contacts and appointments, and we'll talk about that in a second. First, the address chooser task. If you've used the phone number chooser task or the email chooser task, this syntax will look very familiar to you. So you new up an address chooser task, you set the completed event handler, and when the user goes out, chooses a contact, comes back to your application, you have the address, you can pump that into the Bing Maps direction task or use it elsewhere in your application, and you're off and running. Pretty straightforward. You should be able to just copy and paste existing code and make small modifications. Now, with contacts and appointments, before we get into how cool it is and all the scenarios that you can actually enable, I figured I'd just get the sort of bad news out of the way first. And I think that this has been covered a little bit in some of the other talks and in the keynote. But there are 2 important caveats to our contacts and appointments APIs that we're introducing. So the first one is that they are exclusively read-only. So you cannot make edits to the contacts and appointments data stores through these APIs. And really the reason that we're doing that is you've heard time and time again in all of the talks, we want to make sure that the user never regrets installing an application. And so we've seen on other platforms where write capability is provided that sometimes the user's contacts and appointments data stores can get a little bit messy. And so we're not philosophically opposed to doing this. In fact, we believe there are probably a lot of interesting scenarios for it. We simply didn't have the time in Mango to build a model that would allow us to both enable those scenarios and maintain that principle of never having a user regret installing an app. And so we'd be very interested to talk to you about some of the scenarios that you might want write access for so that we can really fine-tune that capability if we are to introduce it in a future release. The second caveat is that third-party social network data is not shared. So you'll see in the People Hub, you can go in and add your Facebook credentials. You can add other accounts through there, some of the accounts that we've got linked through Windows Live. Simply due to the contractual obligations that we have with some of those third parties, we're not able to share that information through these APIs. That's something that's really only available in the People Hub. So with that, let's get back to the fun stuff, which is, what can you actually enable? So like I mentioned, Facebook and the other networks have a limited data set, but we actually have a pretty large amount of data that's shared. So the Windows Live Social, where you've got friends in Windows Live, also your contact list, your sort of local contact list on the phone that gets synced up to Windows Live will also be available through these APIs. Any Exchange accounts, either corporate Exchange or other providers that are using Exchange Active Sync like Google, and then operator address books are going to be available on the contact side. So there's actually a pretty wide variety of data that you can get access to. So how do you actually do it? Now, when I started the talk, I had a bullet point for link to user data. And you can do link against the contacts and appointments data stores. There's a slight nuance to it, which is that the contacts and appointments data stores have been specifically tuned for a set of indices, a set of properties on those objects. And so really what we're pushing people towards is doing the initial query tied to those indices and then doing link queries on the collection that comes back. And so, for example, you'll do a query against contacts where you can set the name or the prefix of the name, and we'll do that query against the index collection that we have, and then we'll return you back an IEnumerable collection that you can do your standard link operations on. So the nice thing here is that we give you the ability to actually perform some filtering on some of the more popular attributes of those the contacts. So name and email and phone are kind of the obvious ones. The one that's nice and unique to Windows Phone is you can actually query on whether the contact is pinned to star. And so you can think of using that as kind of a lightweight, you know, favorite contacts type of model. Appointments follows a very similar pattern. And so you're newing up an appointments object, you're setting a search completed event handler. When you get the results of that back asynchronously, you can go and do your additional link query on it if you want to filter it further, or you can just bind that up to your UI. And so obviously with appointments, the key thing you're going to want to be able to filter on is what is the window of the slice of the calendar that you want to get. So in this case, it's from today to a week from now, and get me back a certain number of items. Okay. So this is actually my last real slide, and then we're going to get back into some demos. So in terms of performance and best practices for using the contacts and appointments APIs, first of all, we're going to obviously include a capability for both of accessing both of those APIs. So if you're familiar with the way the capabilities work today in Windows Phone, the user goes up to a marketplace, up to the marketplace, chooses an application they want to install. Maybe that application wants to use push notifications and location, for example. They will see that in the marketplace listed as, you know, this application is going to require access to the following things. So we're going to have a similar model for contacts and appointments. But we kind of want you to go above and beyond that, right? This data is so sensitive and so important to the user that you should really make sure that you're being upfront about how you're using it. So if you're taking the data from the user's contact list and pushing it up to your service to potentially do some resolution against additional user data that you might have to liven up your application, that's great. But just call that out to the user in your application UI so they know what they're getting into, and they can make a decision about whether they want to enable that or not. The second thing is, you may have noticed that the APIs for accessing contacts and calendar are done asynchronously. The reason we do that is, you know, for larger data sets on the phone. So if the user has, you know, thousands of contacts or appointments, you want to make sure that there isn't any blocking of the UI thread there. But you're going to want to, again, kind of go above and beyond that, right? So your UI is not going to block if it takes a while for that to return. But you'll want to make sure that you're handling it gracefully in terms of providing a loading screen, letting the user know what's going on. In the vast majority of cases, those queries are going to return, you know, in the matter of 1 or 2 seconds. But again, if in sort of the pathological case where the user's got thousands and thousands of contacts and you're not doing much in the way of filtering, that could actually take a little while. And the last thing to point out is that the data returned from these APIs is actually a snapshot. And so you're not getting, you know, live updates of changes that are being made behind the scenes. And so if your application needs the latest data, either from the contact store or the appointment store, and you get, say, tombstoned or FastApp switched away, and then you come back a little while later and you want to make sure that you've got the freshest information, you're going to want to redo that query, because otherwise you may have the data get a little bit stale. All right. So let's switch back over to the application. So now that we've got... Now that we've got the ability to access the user's contacts and appointments databases on the phone, we can do something interesting with this application. So for whatever reason, people seem to think that drinking a lot of wine alone is not a good thing to do. And so why don't we plan a wine tasting with some friends? And actually, I'm going to switch over to the projector for this one, because my device has some contacts and calendar information on it. So I'm going to go in here to plan a wine tasting. Sorry? Okay. You can see that. So I'm going to schedule a wine tasting. And I've got the ability here to select a date and a time. So what I'm showing here is actually a couple of preliminary controls that we've received from Telerik. So we expect with these new APIs that a lot of control vendors are going to do some interesting things and make those available to the broader Windows Phone community to have new and interesting ways to access this information. So what Telerik has done is actually build something that looks very similar to the standard date and time pickers in the native experience on the phone. But they've augmented it with the information that they're receiving back from the from the calendar APIs. And so what they do is show this little number up in the corner on a particular day or time that shows the number of conflicts or the number of appointments for that day. So here's today, there's 6 appointments on my calendar, and so that may not be the best day to have a wine tasting, but let's try tomorrow instead, and that looks a little better. There's 3 appointments, so I'll select that. And then I'm going to choose a time, and it looks like tomorrow at 3 o'clock, I've also got 3 different conflicts. Let's see. Busy schedule. Let's see here. Today, actually, right after this, I should be free. All right, well, I'm going to have to skip those other meetings. In order to have a drink, which seems reasonable. And so now I've selected a time to actually have the wine tasting. Now the next thing I want to do is select a location. And so here I'm going to be using the address chooser task. And I pop that open. It actually turns out in this little subset of contacts that I have on this device, only one of my contacts has an address. So whether she likes it or not, Anna's going to be hosting the wine tasting. So thank you, Anna, in advance. So we're going to do that in Seattle. And then the last thing I'm going to do is actually go and choose a set of contacts. And so the date and time pickers that I showed were from Telerik. This particular control is just something that's homegrown, but it shows the power of these APIs. So this actually allows me to do something that looks very similar to the single contact chooser on the phone, but allows me to select multiple contacts. So let's see, Andrew, Arturo, and Chris, we're going to get together. And I guess I should invite Anna as well since she's hosting. And select that. And I have those guys show up. And so I can get not only their name, but also the contact picture. And so I can enable this type of really bright and lively UI. And so now that I've done all that, I can just go ahead and send an email. So I populated all that information that I got from those controls, put them into an email, and I can send that off. And so now we're all set to have a wine tasting. And the last thing I want to show, actually jumping back to the database portion of the talk, is what you might think of as the first instance of business intelligence on Windows Phone 7. So I'm actually taking the Silverlight charting controls, doing a simple group by statement of the wines that I've consumed and marked as finished in the application, and turning that into a pie chart. And so this is a fairly simple example, obviously, but you start to see the power of being able to take that information, do interesting queries on it, and tie it together with the controls that we have on the phone. And so with that, I'm going to say thanks. Thank you for coming to Mix. Hope you guys are excited, as I said, about all the new platform features that we're adding in the phone. Like I said, it's just incredibly, incredibly exciting to feel the energy here, particularly yesterday in the keynote when people were literally applauding and hooting out in the audience when they saw database on the screen and saw contacts and calendar access on the screen. And so we're really excited to go back to Redmond and finish strong and get these tools out to you as soon as possible. So with that, thank you. And take some questions.
Hello. Three little questions. The first one is, does the link to SQL support transaction scope?
Transaction scope. I don't know the answer to that.
Or transactions at all?
So being able to manage your own transactions?
Yeah.
No, it does not.
Okay. Does it support attaching entities?
Attaching entities, yes.
Okay. And the third one is there a specific query string for me when querying the context database? If I wanted to get my own picture, for example? Because there's the me tile, so that's the me contact. Right?
Yeah, no.
No? Okay.
Sorry, so just to actually repeat those questions, the first one was, does Link to SQL on the phone support transaction scope? So that was the ability to basically manage your own transactions, something that's available in desktop Link to SQL. The answer is no. The platform manages the transactions and submits the changes for you, so you're not able to do additional management of that. The second question was about supporting attaching to entities. The answer to that one is yes. And the third question was, for the contacts API, is there a special way to query for your own information from your contact list? And the answer to that is no. Yes.
I believe you said that we won't have access to third-party contact information. So how does that work? If, for instance, in Facebook, those contacts are loaded into your people page, does that mean you just filter those out and we can't see them, or does it mean that anything that gets put in the people hub, do we have access to that?
So the question is, I mentioned that you can't get access to third-party data. What does that mean? Because all of that data is available in the People Hub. Are we just filtering it out? How does that work? So first of all, I'll point out that with Facebook, you can get access to a very limited amount of data, which is the contact name and photo. But the way that we actually do that is that the People Hub on the phone is pulling together all of those different contact lists that you've synced down from those different services and showing them to you in a combined UI. So they're still actually managed as separate data sets on the phone, and it's just that the People Hub experience that's pulling them together into a combined view. And so the logic on the contacts and calendar APIs is basically just not choosing from those locations.
Right. So I'm seeing that if I'm a user and I look at my People Hub and I see a person's name, and then I go to your Wine app and I say, let's invite that person, and I look, and they're not there, they're like, why isn't that person there? They're not going to know it's because they were filtered out due to this.
Yeah, so that may be a good reason to have some notification. If that is a concern for your application, that you expect that most users are going to want to select from their Facebook contacts, you may want to notify them in your UI to say this is only selecting from these locations. Unfortunately, we just can't share that information based on our agreements. So.
Two questions. One regards the Link to SQL Designer. Any plans to support that?
So that will not be supported in the initial release of Mango. So the desktop tooling that works against SQL CE today is not properly optimized for the phone version. You may be able to use it. In most cases, we think it'll work, but it's not officially supported in the initial release.
Second question, a common scenario around SQL CE has to do with sync services. Any plans to integrate some sync services support and things like that?
Yeah, so the question is about sync for SQL CE. So we're looking at that. We don't have anything to really tell you today, but we have been talking to the sync framework team about potentially enabling something out of band to enable at least a basic sync scenario, but we don't have any official plans for that as yet.
Hey, my question's about querying all of your contacts. Is there going to be any additional scrutiny when you submit your application to the marketplace, that if you select contacts as one of the things you're going to access, that someone actually goes and checks that you're not just grabbing the contacts and uploading them to some server in the ether, just kind of wholesale?
No, there aren't going to be any additional certification rules in that respect. So the question was, is there going to be additional scrutiny for applications that are using the contacts API in terms of how you're actually using them? We don't currently have plans for additional certification rules there. We expect that the user will look at the list of capabilities that the application is requesting as part of the marketplace purchase and install process. And that, again, we're kind of looking to you as the application developer to really disclose what you're using those contacts for.
All right, thanks.
Just a question about the possibility of replication with SQL Server and SQL Server, maybe?
Yeah, so the question is about replication to SQL Server. So that will not be available in the initial release. Again, we're looking at the sync problem all up and trying to have a good long-term solution for that, but we don't have anything to announce at this point.
Hi, my question is about application update.
Yep.
When the database from the previous update, does it persist through when the user updates the application?
Yeah, so the question is about updates and whether the database persists across those updates. So if you remember back to the slide that I showed where there are two locations for databases, right? You have your isolated storage where you can have any type of data, and now we're going to enable you to create a database there. If you do an application update there, that isolated storage is completely untouched. So your database that you've already created in your previous version of the application will stay intact there. If you happen to have a reference database, so a read-only database that was located in the app data folder, then on an update that will get wiped away and installed with the new version. And so you'll want to make sure that if you do have a reference database that you're continuing to include that in your package when you do updates if you want to be able to continue accessing that. But that allows you to basically, if you had, say, reference data that you wanted to update with every update of your application, you could do that, just include that file with the same name in your Zap package, and when your application runs after it's been updated, you'll be able to go and query against the latest version of that database.
So if you change the file name on an application update, the old file just persists there like infinitely, like indefinitely?
If you change the file name like in isolated storage, yeah, so if you have a your file name for your V1 application is v1.db, and then you create a v1.1 and you call it v11.db, then yeah, v1's still going to be there, but now your updated application is going to be working against that other version. And so if you want the updated app to be able to talk to the old version, you'll want to keep that file name the same.
Okay. Thank you.
Just to check, you can't actually rename or remove columns or indexes or fields? You can only add them?
No. So
you'd have to roll a second database and do the thing.
Yeah, exactly. So the question was, can you rename columns, do dropping of tables, and all of those sort of additional more complex schema migrations? And the answer is no in this release. So what we tried to do was tackle the kind of mainline database upgrade scenario, which is ads. And you know, we're definitely interested in looking at making that more robust over time. But yeah, as you say, the solution for that is you're going to create a new data context which has your new schema in it. You'll query from the old one right to the new one, and then you can just delete the old file.
Okay. And the other thing is, you said there isn't a sync solution. The sync framework CTP recently had samples to actually sync with Windows Phone 7 before all of this happened. What's happening with that?
Yeah, so the question is about sync and the sync framework's CTP for Windows Phone 7. So they built a CTP working with isolated storage And so, as I said, we've talked to them about potentially revving that for our new data stack. We want to figure that out eventually, but we don't have any specific plans for it at this point. We realize that it's an important scenario, though, so it's on the top of our list.
Will there be any way for consumers to get an idea of how much space the data for a particular app is using?
So the question is, will there be a way for consumers to get an idea of how much data their app is using? No. So as in 7, there isn't really a system-wide facility for users to find out which applications are using how much storage. Obviously, you can provide that within your application to tell the user how much data is being stored, but we don't have a system-wide UI for that.
So the Identity Framework team just released 4.1, which has a code-first approach, right? And this seems to be like a linked to SQL compact edition code-first approach for the phone. Is this going to be the long-term approach, or is there going to be at some point transition to Identity Framework code-first?
Yep. So the question is, the Identity Framework team just recently released their sort of code-first model. And this looks very much like a linked to SQL code first model. What's the long term story? We've talked a lot with the Identity Framework team. Most of the audience is familiar with linked to SQL. I'm sure you're familiar with some of the background of Microsoft's data investments. The reality is that the Identity Framework, as it stands today, is not optimized to run on a mobile device. We are working closely with the Identity Framework team to try to converge at least the API surface over time so that we don't have two things that look similar but are different. But at this point, they are sort of on parallel tracks. Any other questions? All right, then I think we'll wrap up. Again, thanks again for coming to Mix. Hope to see you again next year. Can't wait for you guys to get your hands on the tools and start building apps.